Steve King and Johnny Putman in for John Williams with the Wintrust Business Lunch. And boy, a lot of stuff going on.
Yep.
A lot of people, understandably, upset about the Fed raising the interest rates.
Right, right. Big story today. Farron Dawgs joins us. He is the founder and CEO of Harrison Wallace Financial Group. You can find them at harrisonwallace.com. Farron, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Obviously, the big story is the Fed raising the interest rate by another 0.75 percentage point. Did that come as a surprise to you?
Well, hi, Johnny and
hi.
Steve. It's great to be with you
thank
today.
You.
It didn't really come as a surprise to me. In fact, there was actually a small chance they would go 100 basis points, a full percentage point. So I think they stayed in line with what was expected. So I was a little surprised that the market was so shocked by by that information. But I think what it was more shocked with were the comments that came out afterwards. Chairman Powell made it very clear that he intends to continue to stay the course with the effort of getting inflation back down to 2%, which I think is a big ball to carry right now. It's interesting to me that everyone is so focused on the Fed, but we do have to realize that there are some supply side inflation things that are not really being addressed. And I personally wish that they could focus a little bit more on that, and that's not really the Fed's job. That's more on the government side. I think what we're seeing is we're really seeing a tug of war with the Fed is trying to raise rates to stem demand, correct? And by doing that, hopefully bringing down prices because you don't have as many dollars chasing the goods. However, on the other side of the coin, we have a lot of stimulus plans that are being rolled out and a lot of packages that are being rolled out, which actually put more money into the system. So we really have a conflict here about how is this all going to work? When you have more money coming into the system, that creates more inflation, but the Fed is doing everything it can to reduce it. So we definitely have some challenges ahead, and I think we need to get everyone on the same page in order to achieve this as quickly as possible.
Should we expect that this will have any impact on the upcoming holiday season?
Oh, I believe so. I think people are having to make choices about, you know, what they're going to be able to afford to purchase, right? And right now, a lot of families are struggling just to kind of keep the basics going, whether it's food and shelter. I mean, we've all seen the reports about, you know, rent rates going up, you know, into the double digits over this last year over year. And the focus is on that. And so I think the holiday season could be pretty muted because, you know, some of those gifts, some of those larger item gifts that might usually be nice to see under the tree might not be there because people might take a break and say, well, I don't need the newest generation of this technology. I'm good with what I have. It's more important for me to have dinner on the table.
Yeah, yeah. I was in a big box store in Florida last week, and they had a giant sign on the window that said, don't miss out on Christmas this year. We have a layaway plan. And I thought, you know, I grew up with in an age when layaway plans were the norm. And I thought, wow.
Everything old is new
again.
You know,
they're saying, come and shop.
Right.
Don't be afraid.
Right, right. Like, we'll put this on an installment payment,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's interesting. And I think we will see more and more of that, especially with those bigger ticket items, no doubt. So, but I think we have a ways to go. The Fed is very focused on getting this inflation down. And as I mentioned, I think we need to realize this is both a demand and a supply side inflation driven environment. But at the same time, they are using, you know, lagging indicators to make these forward thinking decisions. And so I'm hopeful that they don't overshoot this. And, you know, we may start to see, because interest rates have gone up significantly on mortgages, for example, we're already starting to see the housing market slow down from what it was. I'm just hopeful that they don't overshoot this. And then all of a sudden, these lagging indicator reports come in and say, oops, I guess we went a little too quick.
Yeah, good point.
There is a There is a concern about that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time today. Nice talking to you, Farron Dogs, founder and CEO of Harrison Wallace Financial Group. You can find him at harrisonwallace.com.
Steve King and Johnny Putman, and for John Williams on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And now we segue to one of my favorite places is CNET.com. And we're joined by Joan Salzman, who's a senior reporter for one of my favorite places. Hey, Joan, how you doing?
Hi, Joan.
Hi, it's such a warm welcome.
Well, thank you for joining us, but I'm not sure I'm going to be real happy about one of the stories we're going to talk about more spam coming into our Gmail accounts.
Because we don't have nearly enough.
Right.
I know. The saying is there's nothing certain but death and taxes. I think spam needs to be on that list for
yes.
sure. It's not any kind of spam, though. It seems like if you have a Gmail inbox, you may start seeing more political campaign-related spam. That's because Google is reportedly initiating this controversial pilot program in Gmail that basically removes the automatic filters that sometimes shuffle campaign and political-related emails into your spam folder. Now, this is because there was a study earlier this year that found that Gmail filters had, they sent 77% of emails from Republican candidates to spam in 2020. Only 10% of Democratic candidates' emails were marked as spam. And so there was a hubbub over bias, and this is Google's response to that.
Now, will you as the individual, will you still be able to say, okay, Joe Shlobotny, from the checkerboard party, I don't want to get any more of his mails?
Yes, you will. The difference is there's two differences. One is that previously the checkerboard party's emails may have automatically been going to your spam. Now you'll have to see it and take action on it yourself. So the onus is more on the user rather on those automatic filters, taking them out of your line of sight. Mm-hmm. The other change is that these emails that are getting special permission to bypass the filters will have a more prominent unsubscribe button. That's something that they're hoping will take some of the burden, some of the onus away from having to go through and individually get rid of some of those campaign emails.
So someone at Google said, you know what, we're going to tick off a lot of people. So maybe we could put a button in there. Because really, I don't see any upside to this. Because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the original report that caused a bit of hubbub, the researchers who did this report that said, you know, Republicans were booted more often, booted over to spam more often than Democrats, they said, well, maybe we kind of took these figures out of context, you know, lighten up people. But Google said, no, let's do this and put more spam into people's Gmail accounts.
Well, you're not alone. There was, so the reason that Google had to get permission from the FEC in order to try this pilot program. That was all a reaction to Republican GOP lawmakers' criticism. You know, naturally, that's the one the study showed the bias more towards GOP lawmakers' campaigns than Democrat. And so there was a hubbub, there was outlash from GOP lawmakers. But during the public comment period, when the FCC was making a decision, overwhelmingly, the majority of public comments were that, don't do this. We don't want any more spam. So you can see that it's definitely Google reacting to the political climate and not necessarily what may be in users' best interest. Now, the caveat is this is a pilot program. It's small. Only a select number of campaigns are going to be in this pilot program. So it's not opening the floodgates completely yet.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a reason to switch to AOL.
Right, Netscape, absolutely.
Yeah. And we actually do have an AOL account.
Yeah, we
which
do.
Is, seems to be,
and it actually works very well.
It's one of many, but it seems to be pretty stable. Before we let you go, Joan, there's a story about Spotify is going to be making audiobooks available. And that really piqued my interest until did I read correctly? They're going to be charging us?
Right. So Spotify has launched audiobooks. It's initial rollout. It's trying to expand. You know, Spotify went from music into podcasts, and now it's moving into audiobooks. But the difference is Spotify, I'm sure you know and your listeners know, it's always sort of been known as a place that whether you're a free user who hears ads or you're a premium paying member, you can go to Spotify and you can basically listen to anything. There's not paywalls around the audio content there. This is going to be different. If you want to listen to an audiobook title, even if you're a paying subscriber to Spotify, you still have to pay title by title for those audiobooks. Now, Spotify says they'd like to innovate, they'd like to change things, and this is only the first market that they're rolling it out, but it's going to be a very traditional store in that sense, very different for Spotify.
Interesting. And coming up, we're going to be talking about a bookstore and the importance of brick-and-mortar stores. Joan, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon on The Business Lunch. Nice to meet you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
As we mentioned, we have long been supporters of mom-and-pop small businesses.
Yep. In fact, a couple of our all-time favorite businesses happen to be in the very town that our guest, Nina Barrett, hails from. Evanston, Illinois is a wonderful community, and Nina is the owner and founder of Bookends and Beginnings in Evanston. Nina, thanks for joining us this afternoon on The Business Lunch. You did a commentary that ran in the Chicago Tribune last week. For people who did not get to read that commentary, let's do a little background on your store. How long has Bookends and Beginnings been around in Evanston?
So we opened a little more than 8 years ago. Some people may remember the space that we're in as a former store that was here called Bookman's Alley, which was used in antiquarian books. But when that store went out of business, I opened a new store called Bookends and Beginnings. It's charmingly located down an alley in the middle of Evanston, so maybe a little hard to find. And we focus primarily on new books, but we do also carry used books.
I'm going to ask you to give the specific address.
Yes.
About 2 years ago, we opened an additional storefront, which is right out on Sherman Avenue at 1716 Sherman Avenue. Mm-hmm. So the easiest way to navigate to us is find the Bookends and Beginnings stationery store at 1716. And then you're going to see slightly to the south of that address, there's an alley. And you walk into the alley, and people say it's like walking into Diagon Alley in a Harry Potter book.
Yes.
You're going to walk down the alley. You're going to think, this alley doesn't look very promising. I don't think there's anything here.
I love this.
But then you're going to stumble into this bookstore, which is in an old garage. But I promise you that when you open the front door, it will be, people say that it's the kind of bookstore that that is magical, that is everybody's sort of fantasy of a bookstore, because it rambles, it's cozy.
This sounds like you're describing the next Harry Potter novel.
Yes.
Kind of. I think if J.K. Rowling Yes, right. And a wizard will tell you which books you should read next, but it won't be an algorithm wizard. It will be a human being wizard. That's our secret.
Well, and I keep thinking there's a special knock on the door that you're not going to tell us until you decide if you like us or not. So
tell them Joe sent you. Oh.
So I will say another thing about our store. I mean, because people sometimes have an idea of a bookstore as being a snooty place that they have a little bit reservations about coming into, because they think people will judge them or they won't pronounce the name of the author correctly. We have a complete no judge policy. Whatever you want to read, we just love that you're reading.
Yes, yes. Do you have a cat in your bookstore? It's a requirement that you have a cat.
I know. So we did do a poll a few years ago because we kind of wanted a cat. And then we heard from the cat allergy faction.
Of course.
Oh,
good point.
Sure.
And
yes.
So we decided, well, we didn't want to exclude anybody.
Good point.
You know,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, now, over 8 years ago, when you decided to take this leap, and I'm sure that a lot of restless nights wondering if you were doing the right thing, Amazon did exist back then. And I'm sure that was the key thing that people threw up at you. Well, why would you be doing this when people can buy on Amazon? How do you respond to that?
Well, for a long time, as I said in the editorial, I responded in a, you know, sort of nerdy way by talking about our business model and how we would, you know, be able to make it work. But, I mean, fundamentally, I think that there are things about shopping on Amazon that are way overblown. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, yes, books tend to be cheaper there, although not always. But this idea that of convenience, you know, I personally believe that brick and mortar shopping is extremely convenient because mm-hmm. with book shopping for people who are true book lovers, it's really all about the browse. It's about going into a shop that is carefully curated, where there are lots of books on the shelves. There, hopefully we have the ones that you came in looking for, but hopefully we have hundreds of books that you didn't even know existed. And mm-hmm. it's by being in the store, just being able to take a little bit of time out of your day, getting lost, browsing. Most people go out with a much larger stack of books than they anticipated. Mm-hmm. And so that experience really is what we offer that Amazon cannot offer, and it is why I believed that there was still room in a world that is so dominated by Amazon, you know, e-commerce.
Yeah.
There would still be room in the world for the experience of a homey downtown bookstore in
Amen.
A college town.
Amen.
Where you can do what our friend Wayne Jancic, who wrote the Billboard Book of One-Hit Wonders, he loved to go into bookstores and smell the books.
Yes, and people do.
Yeah.
So, yes, and people talk about that with us. They
yes.
talk about the smell of the books. And then the other, our nickname is that we're a speakeasy for books because one of the first people who came in and then wrote a Yelp review called us a speakeasy for books because you had to know the secret of the location, and then you could go in and get mm-hmm. drunk on the books.
Oh, that's
I
good.
I love that.
Yes.
But I read your editorial, but there's one thing you didn't mention in your editorial. And
yes.
we speak of this from personal experience. We wrote a book about Les Paul, and one of the things we found out from our publisher, because we did a lot mm-hmm. of appearances at various places, various bookstores. Yes, the book's on Amazon. Amazon takes a larger percentage
mm-hmm.
than the average bookstore does. So if you want to support your friendly local author, support your friendly local bookstore.
Yeah.
Thank you. And Amazon also is not going to host that event for,
that's
for
right.
you
sure.
and your friendly local author.
Yeah.
That is why you need a physical place in your community that brings authors to you and, you know, lets you meet them and lets them talk about their books.
Yep.
Well, we're going to come see you up in Evanston, and you're going to give me the secret knock for the door because I want to go down the alley and go in there and find out what you've got hidden. So,
And I'm going to give everybody listening a secret knock, and that's the website, which is, oddly enough, bookendsandbeginnings.com.
Nina, thank you for writing the piece in the Tribune so that you came to our attention, and thanks for joining us this afternoon.
And we are going to come to see you in person.
That is wonderful. And I want to remind people that just because they're making a wish list on Amazon, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean they need to order those books on Amazon. If they take that same wish list to me or any other local bookstore in the Chicago area, of which there are dozens of fantastic bookstores in the Chicago area, and they spend those dollars in those stores, those dollars will mean so much more to all of those stores and their survival than they will mean if you send them to you-know-who and he builds another super yacht.
Got it. Thank you, Nina.
Thanks, Nina.
Take care. This is our business lunch on WGN. Let's get some more business news. And here is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new report says Illinois gambling revenue has hit a new high. The report from the Illinois Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability says state gambling revenue hit nearly $1.9 billion as of June 30th. That's an increase of nearly 39% over 2021 and nearly $500 million higher than the pre-pandemic 2019. Cranes reports the bulk of the increase has come from video gambling and sports betting. Video gaming tax revenue has tripled since 2017, now at $762 million annually. Sports betting produced $142 million in 2021. Illinois' operating budget is $43 billion, so the gambling revenue makes up a big chunk of income. Chicago's expanded outdoor dining program could become permanent. It was put in place in 2020 so eligible restaurants could continue to operate during the pandemic with outdoor dining on nearby roadways. The current program is set to expire at the end of the year. The proposal before City Council would establish an outdoor dining street permit to allow eligible establishments to expand operations into the street permanently. I'm Steve Brzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time now for the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Hey, Steve and Johnny. Sure nice to hear you two again. We are sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Driving combines is what a lot of men and women who raise our food are doing right now. Every year, some of those grand, very expensive harvesting machines catch on fire. Illinois is third in the nation in combine fires. Minnesota's first. Iowa is number two. $20 million in property losses each year. 40 to 50 injuries, sometimes death. Lindsay Tobin tells us that she feared the worst for her dad.
Is he alive?
Lindsay is part of our Nextar media family. She reports for WHBF-TV and the Quad Cities. Like a lot of farm kids who go off to city jobs, she was home helping with harvest.
I got done with my field work, went into my mom's house to say goodbye, and that's when I saw it.
What she saw was thick black smoke rising from a field.
I knew it right away. I knew that was my dad.
And as she jumped in her car to rush to the smoke, her mind raced.
Is he going to be dead? Did he make it out of there?
And then...
that's when I saw him barreling south down the gravel road, and it was instant relief.
The combine was totaled, a victim of grain dust, grease, and heat sparking into a spectacular fire. Keith Schneckloth is the Eldridge, Iowa Volunteer Fire Department Chief.
That little spark can make it go boom, and when that happens, then that stuff around it can catch fire, whether it be the belts or the grease and fuel on the combine.
And the chief says it's important to have multiple fire extinguishers that are charged and up to date in and around the machines. But don't be a hero.
When you look at that fire and you say, can I put this out with one fire extinguisher? And if the answer in your head is no, that's time to get away and start getting that resources. I strongly encourage farmers to have a piece of tillage equipment lined up in the fall or maybe even hooked up ready to go in the event something does happen.
Yeah, those dry fields can burn like crazy. We are nearing the end of National Farm Safety and Health Week, but I'm sure the chief would agree that we should pay attention to it every week and every day, for that matter. From the dairy farm to your belly, today is National Ice Cream Cone Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Steve King and Johnny Putman in for John Williams on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And now we're joined by Matt Schultz, LendingTree Chief Credit Analyst. And Matt, I have to tell you, I'm fascinated by a survey that you have about how much sports fans spend. This is... I don't believe, I want to hear it from your mouth, but I don't believe the figures I'm seeing.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a lot of money. Our survey found that 41% of Americans will spend money on sports fans during the fall, and the average spent is about $660.
The average.
Yeah, and that's clearly a lot of money, but anybody who has been to any professional or college sporting event or even just tried to go and buy a Justin Fields jersey mm-hmm. knows that it's pretty easy to have the money go pretty fast.
Well, does this total include parking, for example? Because I'm thinking if you are a Bears season ticket holder, $664 is your parking right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. Yeah, it does include things like that. The biggest costs were game tickets, merchandise, food and alcohol for tailgating, but it did include things like parking as well. And you're right, parking can be really, really expensive.
You also report that 59% of the parents whose children play fall sports say the cost is a financial strain. And I'm looking at the figure and I can understand why. What did you come up with, Matt?
Yeah, we found that about 20% of folks who have kids who play sports in the fall say that they spend $1,000 or more on those fall sports. And as a as a dad of a 16-year-old athlete, I can tell you that it is an expensive thing. So it doesn't surprise me that so many people are struggling to pay.
Yeah. And you only have one involved in sports, because I have a friend that has four involved in sports. I don't even want to know.
I can't even imagine how he did.
I know.
As you look at this, what was the, because you do this for a living, so I would guess a lot of this wasn't that surprising to you, but was there any specific thing that made you say, whoa, I didn't expect that one?
Well, it's actually kind of funny. That 41% of Americans who say they will spend money on as sports fans, that number actually seemed a little low to me. Because there are few things that Americans are more passionate about than sports. Mm-hmm. And the idea that 60% of Americans won't spend a dime on sports this fall kind of struck me as a little bit surprising, mm-hmm. even if the amount of money spent by those who do spend money is really high.
You know, that's a good way to look at it, because when you said it, I went, oh, okay, so I'm in that 60% group. I have friends with me. Is there a difference in gender? Do men spend more than women? Or
Yeah. Generally speaking, they do. The biggest spenders are higher income folks, Gen Xers, and men. Folks who make $100,000 or more a year spend a little over $900 on sports in the fall, and it's a lot easier for those folks to spend that money than it is for folks who don't make quite as much. But this is sports spending is something that everybody across incomes, genders, and other demographics are doing.
Mm. Is there a breakdown into the kind of sports? And I know we're running out of time, but here's where I'm going with that. We travel back and forth to Florida. There is no fan more fanatic than an Alabama Roll Tide fan. So,
that is true.
So where I'm going with this, are college football sports fans more likely to be the most fanatic and the most willing to spend whatever?
Well, we didn't break it down college versus pro and like that, but we did see that football was definitely the sport that people were most likely to spend money on. And you're right, down south, and I'm in Austin, Texas, it's college football. But around the country, there's no question that the NFL is a big driver of spend, too.
Matt, pleasure meeting you. Thank you for the information. Matt Schultz with LendingTree. He's the chief credit analyst, and you can find them at LendingTree.com.